Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is 8/29/2002. Today's session's title is Christians, Lutherans in Palestine and Israel. This will be presented by Anne Hofton. The tape can be found at HAA 2002, Session 4. Let's listen in.
And then they like to answer, well, Pentecost. We were there. Our people were there. As a matter of fact, there's, of course, the area of the Middle East has been an area of constant transition and people coming in over the centuries. So lots of folks who are Palestinian Christians have their roots in Greece and other places as well. But there has always been a faithful Palestinian Christian group in the Middle East, in what was the larger Palestine and now is in the West Bank and in Israel. They are predominantly Orthodox, and the whole series of churches that make up the Orthodox part of our Christian family. And this is often strange to American Protestant folks who go to the Holy Land on a seminar or on a Holy Land trip. I've led a couple of them, and I always try to kind of help them see early on that, you know, these folks are Christians, but they aren't just like us. They share the faith, but they dress differently. They have different rituals. They're mostly from the Eastern Orthodox tradition. Greek Orthodox are the highest number, and then the Copts, the Syrian Orthodox, the Armenians, and on the more Roman side, the Roman Catholics, the Greek Catholics. That's a special little group. And then the Protestants. There are some 30 Protestant denominations that have churches, church bodies in the Middle East. And most of the Protestant work in the Middle East began in the late 19th century. Some of the folks that went there were missionaries who wanted to renew the faith of the populace, or didn't really have any better understanding of Middle Eastern Christians than folks do today. But mostly they were folks of goodwill who wanted to do health ministries and education ministries. So the biggest Protestant groups in Jerusalem and the West Bank are the Anglicans, the Lutherans, the Baptists, and there are also some Nazarene, and then some much smaller and independent groups. The Lutheran Church in Palestine began in 1841, and really the cornerstone of the Lutheran mission in Palestine is the big hospital on the Mount of Olives that was begun in 1851 by some Germans. Also folks of goodwill bringing some medical missions to that area. But the whole Palestinian Christian community, along with the whole Palestinian community, was disrupted in 1948 when the war occurred between Israel and the Arab states, the event that the Palestinians called the catastrophe that resulted in so many people being uprooted from their homes and moved either into refugee status or fleeing to Europe or emigrating. And one of those stories comes from a ELCA pastor who works in the Chicago office now, formerly a parish pastor. Well, I think he's half-time in the church-wide office and half-time parish pastor in the Chicago suburbs. His name is Bassam Abdullah. He grew up in the old city of Jerusalem. Should I close that door? minister here when we can. He grew up in the old city of Jerusalem, and his folks built a new house in a part of West Jerusalem in the years just before 1948, and they lived very happily with their Jewish neighbors, and everything seemed to be moving along toward a time when their children would grow up. His father was a teacher in the Lutheran school there, the Lutheran Boys Orphanage, which also had a school. And that's where Bassam attended school. But he tells a story about how in 1948, in the winter, in the middle of the night, some knocking came on the door, and there were at that time fringe terrorist Jewish groups operating pretty much the way the fringe Palestinian terrorist groups operate now. They came to the door, and Bassam's father went and answered it, and he said, he was told, "You need to pack your things and leave. We're clearing out this neighborhood. We want you out. If you're still here tomorrow night, we'll kill you." And so he didn't leave right away. He went and talked to his Jewish neighbors and was assured by them, no, those people are fanatics. It's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. You stay. We want you. And it'll be fine. The next night, they came back and knocked again, the same six terrorists. They made the same threat: if you're here tomorrow night, we will kill you. So Bassam's father went back to his Jewish friends and said, "No, this is really scaring us. We don't know what to do. What do you advise?" And his neighbors said, no, stay. You know, this is not going to amount to anything. You'll be safe." The fourth time the six men came back to their house in the night, they had threatened them now. They picked up off the porch on their way in the rabbits that Bassam's father was raising as a hobby and as a money, for a little extra money. They laid all those rabbits out on the living room floor and shot them in front of all the children and told them, "If you're here tomorrow night, this will be you." Well, that was pretty much it. Bassam's father loaded the family up. They took a couple suitcases with family documents. They left everything else behind. Left their home that they had just built and ran to the village where Bassam's father had grown up, and in the West Bank. And they've never returned. His father died. His mother has never been able to return to that house. And Bassam went to the United States to study, to university and to seminary, and was ordained. But he cannot go back except on a visa. This is often a problem for folks who want to study abroad. Once they have left, they can't get back in. And Bassam is now a pastor in his, I'd say he's in his 50s, and he cannot return to the land of his birth and live there and minister there. He can only return on a tourist visa. So that happened to a lot of people at that time. And it's a terrible parallel to some of what's happening now, and it was so long ago. That orphanage where Bassam's father taught was the Syrian orphanage for boys, and that was a source of a lot of leadership for what would become the ELCJ, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jerusalem. It was established in 1959. It's a small church, as church bodies go. It has about 2,000 members, plus some extras who live in parts of Europe or the U.S., but they're still members of the church, but they are not resident there, and they can't live there. They have six congregations, one in Jerusalem, in Beit Jala, in Beit Sahur, in Ramallah, and one in Amman, Jordan. And for such a little church, I mean, there's congregations in Minneapolis with way bigger populations than this whole church body, but they're extremely productive, and they have five schools going, and they educate a lot of children with a fine education, and educating the Palestinian community has always been a real high value of the Lutherans. So these schools serve all denominations, and 20% of their student body are Muslim on average. They don't discriminate. Any child can come to the schools of the Lutheran Church there. They have a number of commitments. They're very committed to the education that will raise up leadership, and that's been part of their heritage. They also put in place a kind of the kinds of institutions that they describe as encouraging people to be steadfast. So the schools and the church institutions have as one of their missions keeping the people strong and keeping them in the country, because the urge to immigrate is so strong when the economy is so bad. One of the big ministries of the Lutheran Church, the Global Lutheran Church, is in Jerusalem, and that is the Augusta Victoria Hospital. And there'll be I'm going to show a few minutes of video that explains some of what they do. They also employ a lot of Palestinian folks from the West Bank. And the curfews and the closures and checkpoints create a bad problem for them in their movement to and from their job. But I'll say more about that in a minute. We have missionaries, ELCA missionaries, in Jerusalem, and they ask for our prayers. They are the Kavangas, who teach in Ramallah, Michael and Susan Thomas, who are pastors at the English language congregation in Jerusalem, and Mary Jensen, who's not a full-fledged missionary, but she's a volunteer. She works as communication director for Bishop Yunnan of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jerusalem. About the Redeemer Church, where Michael and Susan are, they're right almost across the street from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, or the church the Arabs call the Church of the Resurrection. And it's a big and beautiful church with a flourishing Arab-speaking Lutheran congregation. And they like to say of themselves, I like this, you know, our congregations are always trying to come up with a catchy motto or a really short mission statement we can put on our webpage. Theirs is, we live in the resurrection neighborhood. I kind of like that. Some other points about the ministries of the ELCJ that are particularly supported by the U.S. Lutheran Church. One is in Ramallah, the Friends School there, where Peter serves as a teacher. The Lutheran Church of the Redeemer, with their special ministry to pilgrims and the English language community. The International Center of Bethlehem, which is administered by Pastor Mitri Raheb, which experienced a lot of damage and a lot of horror during the incursions of this past spring. That center is growing. They have lots of dreams. They have a special academy school. They have plans for a media center. They have what will be the largest auditorium for presenting theater or multimedia presentations in the whole West Bank. At least that's what they told me. And then, of course, Augusta Victoria Hospital. And also a very fine agency called the Peace Center for the Blind that provides educational and vocational training for the blind people. Okay, a few words about what it means to be under curfew and in basically a walled-in state. Bishop Yunnan has described the congregations of the West Bank as being walled in, because each is isolated in its community, which is under curfew, and the people cannot move from one place to another. And he, for example, he can't go and visit as bishop and visit the congregations that he's responsible for supervising. And those pastors can't get out and move among their people and minister as they need to. Not to mention being able to move from city to city. But even within their towns, The heavy curfew means that people have to stay in their homes all the time. There was a long period at Christmas Lutheran in Bethlehem, I can't remember, maybe 8 weeks or more, when they didn't have church services. They couldn't have church on Sunday morning because of the curfew. And so people aren't being fed the way they need to, and they're not able to come together as community. They have to meet in small groups and pray as they can. It's very, very difficult. With the unemployment situation in the West Bank at 90%, it is extremely important that those who have jobs can get to them. A number of folks in the West Bank work at Augusta Victoria Hospital, medics, nurses, and hospital personnel. It's almost a full-time job for the director of the hospital on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem to facilitate the movement of his staff to and from their homes. Because of the checkpoints and the curfews, they can't get to work or they can't get home. And he'll spend hours and hours on the phone trying to get the passes that folks need, or sending staff to go and get them, or going to get them himself. It's a bad problem. It's an even more serious problem for people who need medical treatment, and that'll be addressed in the video. But you've, I'm sure, heard the stories of folks who cannot get to the hospital when it's time to deliver their babies. We know that injured people and staff people have been shot and sometimes killed in ambulances at checkpoints. We know that babies born in ambulances have not survived because they should have had the treatment they needed at the hospital. This is life in a prison, and it's these agencies that, you know, you just have to just pray for these folks that are trying to administer services and keep congregations going under these kinds of conditions. I made a note in the subtitle about nonviolence. The Christian communities, and in particular the Lutheran community, is completely committed to nonviolent solutions. They want a just peace. They want a Palestinian state, and they want it under peaceful, nonviolent circumstances. And they are committed to a ministry of reconciliation. One of the hallmarks of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jerusalem is its concentration of ministry among victimization, people who have been victimized by war. And that has been one of their hallmark ministries since 1948. Most of these churches have had a very important ministry to refugees. And those folks are the ones that they've brought their social services and their Christian witness to. They're very committed to peace education. All the curriculum in the Lutheran schools contains a component on peace education and nonviolence. I think it's a remarkable signature of the Lutheran tradition there that they've so concentrated on nonviolence in their elementary and high school education curriculum. And then they're very involved in dialogue with Jews, Christians, and Muslims who want to talk among themselves. And Bishop Unan in particular provides a lot of leadership in his work with the other Christian leaders, the Anglican, the Catholic, and the Greek Orthodox. They have formed a little cadre of Christian leaders from Palestine, and this is the group that I referenced the other night that is trying to get a meeting with President Bush. And so if you have inclination to write a letter, beginning with the Women's Triennial Convention in Philadelphia, we began a little mini campaign to try to write letters to President Bush and ask him to allow this meeting to take place, where Bishop Unan and Bishop Mark Hansen, together with some other leaders from the Middle East, the churches of the Middle East, could get together with President Bush. At this time, they've not succeeded in getting that appointment. But that's the kind of leadership that that the Lutheran bishop and the Lutheran church is providing in this terrible situation. And it's quite remarkable. Such a little church is really contributing a lot to the leadership toward peace there. I have a bunch of handouts that I'll tell you about, but I think I'll let the video tell you two stories. One is about the hospital. I'll just let run it rather than tell you about it. This is a video prepared by the ELCA and distributed through its Mosaic series. It's about a year old. There's three switches over there.
The song you just heard is an Arabic Christian lament that speaks of Jesus, his crucifixion, and resurrection. It is titled, If I Were Among the Crowds.
The refrain translates, If I were among the crowds, I would have shed all my tears and known the meaning of tears.
Palestinian Lutherans know the meaning of tears. They share a land that is home to three of the world's great religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. Although Christians have ancient roots in the Middle East, their numbers today are dwindling. Christian Arabs, specifically Lutheran Christians, represent a tiny minority amidst a complex mixture of Palestinians, Muslims, and Jews. Yet Christian influence and witness touch many lives. Jamila is a shy 12-year-old Palestinian Muslim clinging to life. Her family lives in Badulla, a tiny village near the ancient city of Hebron. Time moves slowly here. The prophet Abraham once tended flocks in these hills. To get water, Jamila repeats a centuries-old ritual. Jamila and her mother care for the animals. Prayers are said in the home. It is a way of life that is as old as time.
When Jamila was two, they discovered that she had a problem with her kidney. And she got various medications for another 7 years until they realized that they would have to do something else for the problem.
To live, Jamila needs kidney dialysis and ultimately a transplant. Like thousands of Palestinians, Jamila and her family turn to the Lutheran World Federation's Augusta Victoria Hospital in Jerusalem.
I think that the Augusta Victoria Hospital and the Lutheran World Federation programs in general in Jerusalem is the greatest statement about Christian and mission in action in the Holy City. This is a Christian ministry of healing that has existed for about 50 years in here. And this is Christianity in action. This is not Christianity in preaching. This is not Christianity except in action. It follows the life of Christ and what he did on the Mount of Olives by way of healing the patients, by way of taking care of the population here. And really, the essence of Christianity here is Christian mission through action.
Built by German Emperor Kaiser Wilhelm II a century ago, the Augusta Victoria Hospital was a tribute to his wife. The hospital served German pilgrims visiting the Holy Land. 50 years ago, the facility was turned over to the Lutheran World Federation. Its mission was to treat refugees fleeing the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. The Palestinians refer to this time as Al-Nakba, the catastrophe. Augusta Victoria and the refugees remain today.
I think the Lutherans should know that the Augusta Victoria Hospital, in my opinion, is the flagship of the Lutheran world outside probably Europe and America in the Middle East. And it is a place where they should be proud of. I think the Lutheran mission here has been always tilted towards helping the poor and the needy. And since it started in 1950 with the refugee problem, nobody to take care of these people, the Lutherans really have done a great and marvelous job in looking after the healthcare aspect. And they were always really the forerunners in helping these people whatever is needed by them.
Augusta Victoria Hospital is an architectural marvel in a city of marvels. The tower looks out on the Mount of Olives and the ancient walled city of Jerusalem. The hospital's arches and columns are strong, noble, meant to last. The staff and service at Augusta Victoria match the architecture. Palestinian doctors, nurses, and administrators touch more than 18,000 lives a year.
We have limited resources, but we try to offer the best services for the patient and to provide whatever is needed for the patient in the best way possible.
Patients expect first-class health care at Augusta Victoria, and they get it. The problem is getting it. Following the 1967 war, Israel occupied the West Bank and Jerusalem. Since then, travel has been restricted. Military checkpoints and patrols enforce the restrictions. For some, it's an inconvenience. For Jamila, it can mean life or death. Three times a week, Jamila treks to Augusta Victoria for dialysis. To get there, she must pass through a series of military checkpoints. Although she was born in Palestine and lived there all her life, Jamila can't enter Jerusalem legally. To get around this, Augusta Victoria provides a document explaining her condition. Jamila's grandfather, Abu Muhammad, explains that sometimes the soldiers accept it, other times they don't.
We have close to 80% of our patients, Palestinians, who come from the Palestinian Authority area or the West Bank. They have to come here because we offer services that are not available elsewhere in the area where they live. They have to cross Israeli checkpoints. And to do that, they need special permits. And those special permits take a long time, and sometimes they are refused to be given to them by the Israeli authorities. So they really have a big journey to come to cross to Jerusalem. The proximity is not too far, but the actual barriers that face them really make things very difficult for them to get to the hospital.
Once she reaches Augusta Victoria, Jamila spends 4 hours attached to a machine.
There are about 40 cases of end-stage renal disease among the Palestinian community below the age of 15 in the pediatric age group. Now, the majority of these patients were not attended to, except a few who can afford it and use the Israeli system. It's a worthwhile service because all these people have still got a profitable life and a very fruitful life in front of them. Jamila, for example, would have been looked at in a general pediatric ward and would have been just given conservative therapy until sort of the moment arrives for her to die, this is how I would put it, without going on a dialysis program, without giving her the proper attention that is also needed to it, she would have died, in my opinion, a few while ago. But now with the dialysis program, she is on, her life has been saved, and she has got a bright future to look for. Not only that, we have started the program only about a year ago, and our idea at this hospital is to expand the dialysis program into also a transplantation program. Because, as you know, these are young kids, and if they are going to continue just for the rest of their life to be on hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis, that is not really something that everybody would wish to be in for the rest of his life. So the transplantation program is something which we are aiming for to establish on this hospital, and then Jamila would be a good candidate to have a kidney transplanted, and then she would have a normal life.
I pray that we will find the necessary funds for Jamila to have a kidney transplant and to make this problem go away and to make her life easier than it is now. Augusta Victoria Hospital is run by Christians. I know that. Without Augusta Victoria Hospital, many Palestinian children would suffer greatly. The Augusta Victoria Hospital has been a savior for Jamila and for so many other Palestinian children.
You can support this ministry of the Lutheran World Federation through your contribution to the ELCA World Hunger Appeal.
To consider a larger donation to help sustain this and other ministries of the LWF, you may contact the ELCA Foundation to learn more about the LWF Endowment Fund.
Please write to the ELCA Foundation at 8765 West Higgins Road, Chicago, Illinois, 60631, or call 1-800-638-3522, extension 297.
Another way the ELCA is making a difference in the Middle East is through schools of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan. Like Augusta Victoria, Lutheran schools make a difference. Dahlia and Andrew are students at the Lutheran School of Hope in Ramallah. Andrew is Christian, Dahlia is Muslim. They're both are bright students with dreams for the future, a future left uncertain because Israelis and Palestinians continue to fight. Ramallah is just north of Jerusalem, near the biblical town of Bethel. But in recent years, Ramallah has been a flashpoint in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There are days when it can be dangerous to go outside. The city is still home to thousands of refugees.
My school was built in 1961. I think it's a great school. Academically, it's excellent. Science is great there. We get good information about science, about social life, about literature. When we leave the school, they help us to move to universities. They help us create a future and new life after school.
Like his classmates, Andrew loves science. He hopes one day to go on to a university and further his education. On the day we visited the Lutheran School of Hope, Andrew's class was having a science fair. While Andrew prefers the laboratory, Dahlia has other plans.
Everyone has dreams in the future, and my dream is being an archaeologist. And I love history and old stuff. Right now I'm learning about the modern history of Palestine from the time of the Jews and British, and it's all war and violence. That's all I know. There's no peace. I take lots of classes and classes a day, and I take lots of subjects. for example, science or mechanics, physics, chemistry, biology, maths, Arabic, English, and German too.
In addition to traditional academic subjects, the Lutheran School of Hope also teaches religion, Christianity to Christians, Islam to Muslims.
It's a Christian school, of course, but we have Muslims. For example, me, I'm a Muslim, and I go to a Muslim class for religion. There's no problem. No one tells me that's my religion. No one asks me. No one harasses me.
As Palestinian and Israeli negotiators work toward a lasting Middle East peace plan, the prospect of an independent Palestinian state may soon become a reality. For educators like Michael Abu Bezalel, training tomorrow's Palestinian leaders is a real priority.
Palestinian students have been hurt a lot by the political situation, and until now, they're still suffering. That's why we hope to get a secure and safe life, the easy life that all American and Israeli students get. We hope to get the easy life so our students can get on with their lives, to play a big role in building their society.
Yuniv Yonam presides as Bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan. The church body represents Lutherans in Amman, Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and Ramallah.
We have in our school 3,000 children. Out of them, only 7% are Lutherans. 55% of them are Greek Orthodox. 31% of them are Muslims. And the others are from the other Christian, other percentages, Christian denomination. We are offering the Palestinian society something more than normal education. We are also trying in our education to be a backbone of the Palestinian education in Palestine. Second, we are maintaining the Christian presence. And for this reason, we are using Christian instruction in our school. But it's not merely instruction. You are also giving the evangelical spirit. Thirdly, we are developing the voters. We are not developing only the intellectual side. We are also developing the vocational skills. For this, we are studying the voters. And fourthly, we are educating people in a society that is multicultural and multi-religious, to live with the other religions, to understand them in the way they want to be understood, and to coexist equally and justly and peacefully. I think this mission is very important. Had there been no Lutheran schools, things would be different.
For students like Andrew and Dahlia, the pressure is on. Not only do they face the normal challenge of adolescence, they are literally Palestine's hope for the future.
I hope in the future that there is peace between Israel and us, and that we will work together in peace as two countries.
Every problem that happens, they say, they just tell us that you are responsible for this, you must deal with it, you must solve it, you must be responsible for what happens. My hope is to continue my life happily, without problems, to study what I really like, what I really want to be. My prayer is to have peace.
There's a footnote to this story.
Because of your giving, the ELCA was able to use extra funds to help support the Lutheran School of Hope and other institutions in the Holy Land. Our final story on the Holy Land starts ironically in Middle America.
It's fun for me to see Andrew Yonan here because he was my student intern this summer at the ELCA and was assigned to work with me. And he's a student now at Valparaiso University and studying computers. And he's just a delightful young man. The sad thing is to see the school at Ramallah And to remember, since this video was made, that the church at Ramallah, the Church of Hope, was very brutally invaded during the incursion. The pastor there was essentially used as a human shield to as they moved from the troops moved from room to room in the church. I don't know about the school in Ramallah, but the church. And the church in, the school in Bethlehem experienced a very serious incursion where, with a lot of destruction, I mean, every computer terminal smashed, all the cross, you know, thrown down from the wall, things broken, hard drives smashed, a whole line of new toilets that were going to be put into the school, each one smashed so it couldn't be used. Just wanton destruction there in Bethlehem at the Al-Kalima Academy, a much newer school than this one at Ramallah. I wish I knew the status of the Ramallah school, but there's another story, a little bit like the Psalms story of his parents' experience in 1948, but it's real current. It was just from this year, and maybe you saw it in the Lutheran magazine, or have heard. Maybe you saw Pastor Mitri Rahib's picture in the New York Times. It was featured there and picked up all around. A picture of Pastor Rahib on the phone through a broken window in a siege. When the Israelis came to Bethlehem, he was with his family. He says that they were hiding behind closed doors, as the families were all throughout Bethlehem. And their home is adjacent to the church, so that a parsonage, so they were together in the same setting with the church. And they were especially fearful because their neighbors, an old woman and a 36-year-old man, had been killed the previous day by the troops. And I don't know what instigated that, but it's hard to imagine what would warrant killing an old woman. The young man had been a student at the Lutheran school. So folks in the Lutheran community, Christmas Lutheran, were grieving those deaths and at the same time really fearful. In the afternoon, the soldiers indeed came to Pastor Rahib's house and to the church. And he said that as they came to into their home, a second unit was already flanking and had already gone into the church offices and done a lot of destruction there. So I'm sorry, it's kind of hard to remember this. I mean, hard to think about it happening to someone I know, you know. He decided, he had to make a decision about what to do, whether to stay with his family and just keep behind closed doors, or march out and confront them. They were obviously had gained entry to the church compound and were, you know, moving freely throughout. So he left his home and went out into the church area. One might be tactically a good idea to divert them from his family and help them avoid at least that most acute trauma. But of course, they already had the trauma of the incursion into the compound. But he stood up and went out and faced the troops and told them he wanted to speak to their commander, their most senior officer. And at the same time, he went to his office as if to say, you know, you come to me. So he spoke to the troops, told them, you know, bring me your commander. Then he went up to his office, which was actually also a critical strategic. Where he could access a phone most easily. And so the soldiers were all surrounding him in his office, and he was speaking to them in Hebrew and also in English. So it was kind of interesting because they didn't really get who he was. They didn't understand who he was. He was not speaking Arabic. I think he also spoke to them in German. He was educated in Germany. But he was speaking Hebrew and English. And then when he got on the phone to Bishop Yonan in Jerusalem, he began speaking Arabic. And then everything changed. They were kind of polite to him up to the point where he began to speak Arabic. And then the soldiers started to get more rough with him and more rough with his office and to insult him and told him that his language was the most ugly language in the world, and he wouldn't back down. He said, well, that's too bad that you say that, because Hebrew, your language, and mine have the same roots. Don't you know that? And the soldier said, well, you're going to pay for siding with the Arabs here now. And he said that he still thought they were confused as to who he was, because he told them he was a Christian Lutheran pastor and a Palestinian, and it was almost as if they were as ignorant of the existence of Palestinian Christians as anybody else. They couldn't seem to process who he was. They still seemed to think that he was someone from outside who had taken the Arab side, but actually, of course, he's an indigenous Palestinian. They brutalized the facility, tore down the art. At the same time, they were saying, oh, you have beautiful art here, and then pulled it down onto the floor. And he said, well, we're trying, you know, to make a beautiful facility here. And every time they with every violent action, every assault on their facility, he kept in dialogue with them, even though it was a kind of a jibing, kind of a banter. But I just imagine the adrenaline at work. At the same time, he's keeping a little dialogue going with them about their efforts to make a beautiful place. And the soldier said to him, you know, something along the lines of, you think you're pretty smart, don't you? And he said to that, his response was, the real wise person is one who can transform his enemy into a neighbor, and not his neighbor into an enemy. And so then they got really mad. They didn't like that answer at all. They told him to, you know, stop talking and that he couldn't use the phone. But in an interesting turn, just at the same time, the commander was being so hard on him and lashing out at him. And he also told all his soldiers to go, to leave that office and leave that space, and eventually to leave the compound. So the Lutherans are suffering, but they are resilient, and they're faithful, and they're really committed to nonviolence. And they
asked... What about the bill he sent?
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
There's a cute thing on his bill.
Yeah, he said... it was actually Bishop Yonan who did that. But I'll tell it. It's a funny story. When Bishop Yonan was able to get to Bethlehem, and he toured the academy and saw the destruction, and also at the media center, at the International Center in Bethlehem, he saw the toilets and everything that had been destroyed there. And then he sent a letter to Prime Minister Sharon, identifying himself with the church there and his, as a leader, and saying, "I enclose a bill for the cross that was destroyed. Everything else," he said, he totaled it up. You know, here are all the destruction: computers, hard drives, terminals, toilets, under areas under construction, all the dollars. Cross from the school, there's that number. And at the end, the total was only the amount for the cross. All the rest, okay, we'll absorb that. You just got to have a little bit of an attitude, you know, in this kind of situation. Will this go off, Barb, if I just yank on it?
Yeah, but you have to sort of push it up too. Yeah, just pull it down and push it up.
Okay. Yeah. Here's how to reach the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan on the web. One of the things, you know, the video obviously is created by the ELCA as a way of informing folks about how their money is used. But us, in addition to that, the one thing the church in Jerusalem has asked of us is prayer and advocacy, those two things. And the easiest one is prayer. And I'll give you some information about advocacy too. They ask us, and they're really serious about this, they ask us to pray for them and pray for them every day. And of course, being an institution, we figured out an organized way to do that. So I'm going to give you this green sheet if you want. This is how to sign up for the Ecumenical Prayer Vigil, which is kind of managed out of the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs in Washington. And if you bring this home for yourself or for your congregation, every prayer helps, and there's a way to get more information too from the web page there. And it's set up in such a way that you can, your state prays not only for the church in Jerusalem, the Evangelical Lutheran Church, but for peace and reconciliation among all the peoples of the Middle East. That's the goal of this prayer. So I know that in Minnesota, we pray on the 25th of each month. I haven't figured out when Texas is yet. But there's a day that we're assigned to pray, and congregations are encouraged to find whatever way is suitable for them, a vigil or individuals just in a organized way, or using the Sunday most adjacent to include it in the prayers of the church. There are lots of ways, creative ways to use prayer. And then the church asks us to help tell their story, not only to each other, but to legislators, to folks who are the policymakers on the issues that are the policies of our own government that are keeping them in these walled-in situations. And these yellow sheets are about that. This is an example of an advocacy alert that is distributed by Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs. I'll put these here for you to pick up. And also this blue sheet, which tells you how to stay in touch with me if you'd like to receive regular bulletins about the ELCJ, our missionaries there, our ecumenical efforts on behalf of peace. You can sign up to receive regular emails from me with this little blue sheet. And then please take one of these folders from the Israel Committee Against Home Demolition. This is really, I'm just pitching this one every session because this is such a great organization, and our church is, through Churches for Middle East Peace, is on board with this effort from an Israeli peace group to restore homes and bring justice to folks who have lost their homes through demolition. There's other things up here too, a bibliography and so forth. Here's how to reach the prayer vigil on the web, and here's how to reach me if you want to stay in touch and receive bulletins about the situation in the Middle East, particularly our Lutheran efforts. Our missionaries are contacts there. And if you like a poster, they're also available. And just see me about that. But I think that's it. There's time for questions if anyone has one or two.
Do you know anything about the story of the Lutheran archaeologist that was teaching at Beer Zeit that was assassinated? And I'm wondering if, it was early 90s or something that was supposed to happen. And I wondered if you know, he was teaching a Palestinian archaeology rather than necessarily a biblical archaeology. And I was wondering if you knew anything about...
What's his name, Barb?
I'm trying to read.
It starts with a G.
Oh, yeah.
It'll come to me if I...
He was an ELCA missionary.
And if they know, in fact,
retired.
Who's being assassinated.
No, they've never solved it. Well, and they've never... It's a mystery. Among some folks, it appears to be political because he was excavating and teaching archaeology in such a way that was teaching a kind of an alternative history, a Palestinian history. But I don't know.
Okay.
I know I never took his class, and I don't know what that really means. He was murdered about 7 or 8 years ago, I'd say. Was it Glock?
Glock. Yeah.
It was Glock.
Yeah.
Al Glock.
Yes. His widow continues to reside in the Middle East, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a peace activist, too. It's never been solved, and another bone of contention among his students and Palestinians and Lutherans is that it didn't look like there was much effort put into solving it. There was no theft, it wasn't a burglary, he was simply murdered in a alleyway or something, something like that. His home, I don't think, was invaded. I think they caught him outside. And a mystery, tragic mystery.
I have a question. Can you write down the specifics, I don't mean in like one or two sentences, of what we're supposed to ask for in terms of that meeting if we write to President Bush? That would be an interesting thing to put in the whole newspaper and get the Holden community working on.
Should I write it on the board?
Yeah.
The essentials are Bishop Younan, and I'll spell it, and Bishop Hansen, the ELCA bishop, are asking for a meeting with President Bush, and they want to get that meeting. So far they've been sort of shuffled over to State Department, you know, advisors, people who work with Condoleezza Rice, and Bishop Younan is so feisty. He's just said, no thanks. We don't want to talk to those people. We want to talk to Bush, you know, bring him on. They want to bring a little contingent of folks from this Christian leadership group in Jerusalem, the Anglican bishop, the Roman Catholic bishop, and the Greek Orthodox leader, and say to President Bush, look, there's a Christian community here. We're ready to work on peace. You know, we can tell you what the problems are. Listen to us instead of these evangelical U.S. Christians who are all out unquestioning support for Israel all the time. There's another Christian point of view, and it's coming from the land. That's what they want to say to him, and so far they haven't got a meeting.
But the Women's Convention started the lettering, so he would know what we were writing about.
Yeah, he's probably got a lot of letters already, but I don't think if I write up here you can't see, can you?
Sure. If it's not yellow, talk. Yeah.
All right. That's it then. Thank you. Anybody else? I'll just write here and we can conclude. Any
Does
other
the
questions?
Name Michael Zuby mean anything to you?
Zuby.
Zuby? Yeah, he's a Palestinian.
Yeah, I think it's spelled Z-O-U-G-B-Y. I think it's pronounced Zuby, but maybe it's Zuby. I only know him as him. I don't know him personally, or he's not a Lutheran. But he's a Palestinian activist,
Palestinian,
isn't he?
Palestinian Christian, yeah.
Christians, exactly. That's a big family, the Zubi family. Number of generations of leaders.
Okay. He, we met him first, my husband and I, on a trip to Israel a few years back. And then he has kept contact with Arlen Jacobson from Concordia College in Moorhead.
Uh-huh.
He studied over there.
Yes.
And he supplied our church, all of us in Fargo, with, this is a couple of years ago, a large supply of olive wood for a carving to be put in the front of our church. And then he has something to do with a group of Palestinian Christians who are wood carvers, but can't anymore sell their carvings to tourists because the tourists are so much more limited. And so he arranged to send a lot of wood carvings to our church in Fargo, and I think in one or two Sundays they sold something like $7,000 or $8,000 worth that went back to the wood carvers in Palestine.
Yep. I've heard of that, and there are a lot of creative ways that American churches are supporting economic efforts there. But it's awful hard to do much, you know, even with no matter how many little wood carvings you sell. The economic struggle there is just impossible.
And just before we came here, there was, and I didn't have an opportunity to pursue it any farther, but on the names read asking for prayers for health was Michael Zuby's wife in Palestine. That's all I know.
I know there are also some folks working on bringing his children to the U.S. for education, but I don't know them personally or the details on that. If you want a big packet of info on the church in Jerusalem, you can get this from the ELCA's Division for Global Mission. This is a resource packet on the church in the Middle East.
Any comments on the Orthodox Church relationship with the others? I know, like in Egypt, the Coptic Orthodox actually pretty much resents the Protestant groups and the missionaries for sheep stealing, and I know the Russian Orthodox is having trouble now with the Protestant groups, and I'm wondering what if the Middle Eastern or the Orthodox in Palestine is sort of caught, because in a way the Protestant groups, or maybe even the Catholic Melkites or whatever you were talking about there, represent competition, but at the same time they're forced. And I just wanted to get
you said it. It's exactly that way. I mean, I think the churches are really trying to work together, but sure, there's a. I mean, in all honesty, I'd say that I think the biggest competition, or the, I don't know, they perceived. threat, you know, to their numbers. See, all their numbers are going down so much because of immigration.
Sure.
People are leaving, it's a hemorrhage.
Yeah.
And so they're really worried about their numbers.
Sure.
I think that the churches, like the Anglicans and the Lutherans and the Greeks and the Roman Catholic and the Greek Orthodox all get along pretty well. They're the big ones, the major ones.
Sure.
And then it's just like here. I mean, there are always going to be some evangelical folks who are ministering to people who aren't being ministered to by the Greek Orthodox. My friend is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
His ministry is to folks who are alienated in the Greek Orthodox Church.
Yeah.
So he's really not a threat to their membership roles at all, but Franz, do you want to help me open up some of these blinds?
Yeah, let me help you. I'm taking up your time.
But they consider him to be, you know, a sheep stealer or something. So it's a problem, but you know, the overarching need for solidarity really is, I think everybody sees that to be the main thing.
Sure.
And then they don't always trust one another, you know, on another level.
No, it's fascinating. We have friends who are in the more conservative fundamentalist churches, and we're getting this stuff about the, you know, pray for the Israelis and the Promised Land and the old Old Testament thing. But also, I haven't talked about all kinds of stuff. Maybe ask for sitting in the evening or something, but I'm in front of Lodge 4. But
I'm here picking up my folder.
Yeah.
I can't get any to take my posters.
Pardon?
I can't get any takers for my posters.
Oh, I'd love to put one up.
Well, let me get a taker.
Oh, yeah. We go to a Lutheran Catholic church with a Catholic priest and a female Lutheran pastor. And so we're pretty ecumenical. Oh, hey.
I'm supposed to accept a donation for that, but I'll give it to you because I'm so happy just to have people take them. And here's my card if you want to stay in touch.
Sure, absolutely.